Chair, requirements, present, first order of businesses. $499. Gail?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gail Moretzky from the Department of Law. The bill before you, Senate Bill 499, is a 16-section bill that does 11 different things, most of them miscellaneous amendments to existing provisions in the motor vehicle laws. There were three different things in general that the bill does. One is clear up ambiguities and, in some cases, outright contradictions which exist in the existing title, motor vehicle laws, Title 28. In other circumstances, they bring the language of the statute in line with current administrative practices. Not that the administrative practices necessarily violate the statutes, but in some cases they're not specifically set out, or they're set out in very vague general terms. And this defines the way certain notices to be given, and the hearing officer can do, powers of the court when suspending the license, etc. The other thing it does is clear up some ambiguities in current law regarding things like taxes versus fees, and one section cross-references to another, and the cross-reference doesn't make any sense because it refers to tax, not a fee, etc. If you'd like, Mr. Chairman, I can certainly go down section by section what each thing does. If you'll recall, sir, this was a topic of discussion in the Senate State Affairs Committee when you were there, and we did somewhat go through the bill there. If you have, Mr. Chairman, in front of you my letter of March 13, there was a suggestion at the Senate State Affairs Committee meeting, which I incorrectly referred to as Senate passing that in that letter, that you wanted, if somebody administratively lost a license or a registration, and then they appealed to district court, if that appeal was successful, in other words, the administrative hearing was overturned, you wanted some language, as I understand it, sir, to allow the person to have the hearing in district court instead of having it sent back to the administrative hearing officer, which is what I attempted to do there in the proposed new Section 4. Be glad to answer any questions about that.
I don't feel like sending it back to the same hearing officer.
You don't feel like sending it back to the same hearing officer?
Positive action that way, I think they would just give it to a different hearing officer.
Okay.
Or conduct a hearing de novo.
That's usually the language would be in one, return the case to the department for a new hearing before a different hearing officer.
The only part of the problem I have with this first part about defacing this is defaced or otherwise altered. I don't think that the average person buying a vehicle, whether it's a new vehicle or a used vehicle, is ever going to look at the engine block to see if the registration number is still on there, if it's been defaced or altered. I don't think anybody's going to do that.
Mr. Chairman, probably not. This, of course, doesn't make it a crime to have a vehicle whose number has been altered.
They just impound the vehicle.
They can impound the vehicle while they can investigate and see if it's stolen. If it's a stolen vehicle, it belongs to the person from whom it was stolen. If a person in good faith bought a car off a used car lot and it turns out to be stolen, he doesn't get to keep the car. The car goes back to the owner. He can maybe sue the guy at the used car lot or demand that he get a different car or his money back, but he doesn't keep the stolen car. We specifically put in here language so that an innocent owner of the car would not have to pay the impound fees. He's not out anything except if it's a stolen car, he loses the car. Same thing if it's a stolen gun and the police find it, you can't keep your gun.
He might be inconvenienced for quite a time.
Yeah.
He may be, sir.
We don't care about that.
It's not that we don't care. I don't know what other alternative there is. Let him keep the stolen car. How do you figure out how it was stolen?
I don't know.
Many cases, not all certainly, but in many cases, someone who is in possession of stolen goods knows either actually or constructively that he's got something that's hot. Usually buys it for half its market value and thinks he's got a great deal. He doesn't inquire into why he can buy it at half the market value. I suppose he's running the risk of losing it later.
In Alaska? Come on. Maybe in California or someplace like that, that would be different. Not in Alaska, I don't think it would be some guy going to try to peddle you the car for half price. I don't know. I'm not picking on you, Gail. This seems like all these laws, they're all fashioned to take care of the prosecutor and the state and the individual he's left out behind. And if it wasn't for the individual, it wouldn't be any use for you or me or anybody else.
I think to a certain extent it's an attempt to protect the individual from whom property has been stolen. And the other thing is that they are now doing it right now. The state troopers are. If they find a stolen car, they do impound it until they can investigate. It's just that the language of the statute does not specifically allow for that. This is more an effect of a conforming amendment to conform it to existing practice than a change in the procedure.
Steal your car somewhere.
Yeah, I don't have to worry about it stealing my car. Although it's only got 15,000 miles on it. Not quite 15 yet. I'm working on it.
Another couple of years.
I don't know why it would be in that section here and it is so defective that it can't drive it on a highway. No, it's really a good shape.
Is it for sale?
No.
Under his attorney's instructions not to buy a new one for the time being.
When are we taking the 65 years of age out on what's that for? When are we taking that out?
Which page is that, Senator?
Page 3 in the line. 16.
This is one of the ones where we're trying to make the cross-references make sense. What Section 6 does is a resident who is 65 years or older on the date the tax is due is exempt from the tax under 431B and the registration fee, and then it lists the sections under which the vehicles are subject to tax, and then it the vehicle owned or by disabled veteran or other handicapped. Okay, you don't have to have the language in 421D3 because you've included it under 2810.411C, which now says registration fee. It used to say tax, you see in brackets there. So the exemption is now contained in 411C rather than 421D3. It preserves the exemption, clearly. It allows them to be exempt both from the fee and the tax. In Section 11, and spouse, and you keep putting spouse in there. I mean, what was the reason for that? Was that an oversight somewhere along the line? Yes, sir. Right now, under current law, if a person is under 18, he may not get a driver's license permit or motorcycle permit unless a parent or guardian signs a form giving him permission to an acceptance of liability for any negligence or damage caused by the minor. If you have a minor who's married, however, the parents either may not be available or may be unwilling to assume that liability, where the spouse, who is an adult, may be quite willing to sign for the applicant. So this allows a spouse who's over 18 to sign, giving permission for a minor to get a driver's license permit and accepts liability for it.
Is that revising?
Will you be able to look at Section 16? And I think there's a problem in expectation of course in the division view.
Section 16 is really very simple. It's more of a common sense thing. What it says up there on page 5 at the bottom, the person is under arrest, refuses to request law enforcement officer after being advised by the officer that the refusal will, the person was arrested while operating or driving a motor vehicle.
So simple, why do we need it?
Well, because a person is never going to be arrested while operating a motor vehicle. He's always arrested afterwards. Obviously, the common sense interpretation I hope that the court would give to that would mean that was a drafting error and it should be for instead of while. But since we were doing an amendment of Title 28 trying to clean up incongruous language, this was one of the things we caught when we went through it. What they're talking about is if somebody's been arrested for DWI, he's been stopped, given the field sobriety test, the officer says, I think you're drunk, and arrests him, then all of this stuff kicks in about he's got to be warned about the consequences and he has to take a breath test. If he refuses, then that's a separate crime. But he's arrested for DWI, not while operating a motor vehicle.
See, if you said that the person was stopped while operating, that's fine.
Yeah, that would
but if you say arrested, he isn't placed under arrest until after he's stopped and he's no longer operating. He's in control of it, but he's not operating.
I can understand while operating or seeing operating a motor vehicle, but could they arrest someone for operating a motor vehicle that might have been yesterday?
Mr. Chairman, without a warrant, a police officer could arrest for DWI up to 8 hours after the offense, does not have to have seen the offense be committed, but must have probable cause, i.e. the neighbor says, I saw him drive into that telephone pole, and then he fell over when he got out of the car, whatever the evidence is. But if the alleged offense occurred more than 8 hours before, then the police officer would have to get a warrant, because it's a misdemeanor arrest, and you can't arrest without a warrant except for specific exceptions.
Well, the fact is, Gail, that now, if this were adopted, it could have the effect of, let's say, Joe Blow is seen driving out of the Yukon Bar at 2 in the morning, and somebody sees him and calls the police and says he's drunk. And I think it's Joe Blow, they're pretty sure. They're pretty sure he's drunk. They call the troopers. They catch up with him 5 hours later at 7 in the morning, and he's asleep in the back seat of his car, or let's say he's wandered off in the bushes and rolled out of sleeping bag. Under this, the officer could go up to him and say, give me a breathalyzer if you don't.
No, sir. Mr.
Put him under arrest.
He has to place him
under arrest. Put him under arrest. Say, I have probable cause to arrest you because of the reports that I heard of your activities at the Yukon Bar 5 hours ago. So you're under arrest. Now give me a breathalyzer.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that's the situation under current law. Any person who is under arrest for DWI has to take the breath test.
I don't know if we're under this here. Maybe the intent of the language, if I continue, Mr. Chairman, the intent of the current language might have been that you have to take a breathalyzer if you're stopped at the scene, if you're observed by an officer and arrested after his observance. But if you're being arrested on somebody else's say-so, you might not have to take the breathalyzer.
Mr. Chairman, nobody could ever be arrested while operating. The language is
no, I understand that. I understand that. But I'm saying that maybe the reason we have this ambiguity, this poor drafting, is that somebody was trying ineffectively, with the wrong words, to accomplish what I'm saying. That is, give them the right to require a breathalyzer if they're caught at the scene, but not if it's 5 hours later on the word of somebody else.
Mr. Chairman,
this is
the criminal possession section.
I never heard that given as an intent. The intent was if you're stopped and the guy places you under arrest, once you're placed under arrest, then you're subject to a breathalyzer. That was the intent of the law, as I remember it, as explained on the floor a couple of times.
How many years ago was this? Was this before they had the change that allowed you to be arrested?
It's been up to, I don't know, it's been up, first time was about 6 or 7 years ago, I guess. Seems like, I don't know.
finance and material. Well, no, the reason I ask is because when this language was first...
What this says is after you're arrested.
That's right.
Well, so then they arrest you, no matter what it is.
Yeah, but it used to be that they couldn't arrest you unless they observed you driving themselves. And then they changed
that. They arrested you for sleeping in the car.
Well, they didn't get away with that.
Oh, yes, they did.
Not when I was defending them.
Right. So far, the people here had a different attorney.
Yeah.
They did. No, they arrested him for, because I can remember a guy was arrested for sleeping on Main Street. He was sleeping in his car on Main Street, a local guy here. And he was arrested convicted for drunk driving. Or not drunk driving, operating.
Substitute, which it usually wouldn't do anyway, unless it
that's what an appeal, as I understand it, is all about. Is that the person who heard the evidence and looked at the demeanor of the witnesses and had a chance to listen to the examination is the one that...
There is an area where, not exactly, there is an area where an appeal court can reverse on fact issues where there is support for the...
Are you talking about the hearing, whether they should file on the person's registration title? I don't think that they can, because I got nothing to do with the privilege. Or is it a privilege to file a title? That's not a privilege. That's a property right. If you have a title in the automobile, that's a property right. That has nothing to do with the person's record as far as he's concerned about him filing on the title of the automobile. File on his license. So that's why I don't understand what you're trying to do here. Why would you file on to suspend or revoke his registration or title?
Senator, this Section 3 applies to all administrative hearings. And you can get an administrative hearing if you...
Talking about Section 2 here.
Oh, I thought Senator Josephson's question was about Section 3.
Section 3 goes into Section 2, but I'm talking about Section 2, which you're adding on registration or title is a hearing on a point system where to suspend or revoke the title or registration. I don't understand that. Why would you do that?
The only situation where you would take a registration or a title is if the registration or title was fraudulently procured. In other words, you lie when you apply for it.
Well, yeah, but then it's pretty broad. Don't you think that you're... I think we have it pretty broad in here.
Senator, this is another example of trying to make the language consistent. Right now, in existing law, right this moment, the Department of Motor Vehicles has the right to revoke both registrations and titles that have been fraudulently applied for. All this does is recognize that ability by putting it in their general
power. The difference you have here is the person that has a problem with the point system. The person's point total.
No,
somehow, why would you, if the registration, you talk about registration or title and if appropriate, the department shall adjust the person's point total.
Yes, sir.
Well, as you're talking about, if appropriate, all right. It certainly would be appropriate on a registration or a title, but the inference is there some way that if there was something wrong with the title, he'd get something out of it, and yet there's no provision in law that he should. The inference that you're drawing there is that the person's license, registration, or title are all up for suspension, revocation, or denial. That's true, but then you should identify and pinpoint the idea that a fraudulent registration or title is the only thing that you can fool with.
That is pinpointed, Senator. It's just
where?
A different section. It's in the existing law. It's in 2810.051. Department may suspend or revoke registration. May suspend or revoke registration if it was fraudulently issued. Determines that the vehicle is mechanically unsafe.
Is that
the
under
vehicle 8? Has been scraped. It's under 2510.051, sir, in existing law.
Well, what you're talking about, if at the hearing under A of this section, under 2505.141.
That hearing applies to everything. If
what
they
does it
want
say
to,
there?
If 041?
Yes, C.
What, you mean 141C?
Yeah, 141A. What does that say?
Oh, that says... unless otherwise specifically provided, all hearings required under this title or regulations adopted under this title shall be conducted by the department under regulations adopted by the commissioner governing practice and procedure consistent with your process. Hearings shall be informal. Technical rules of evidence do not apply. The person who requests a hearing may retain an attorney. The hearing officer shall be appointed by the commissioner or may be appointed from the department. Hearing officer need not be attorney, but must be impartial, must not have participated in the decision which is under review. Hearing officer does not have to file a full opinion, but he must state the reasons for his determination and indicate the evidence relied on. Proceedings shall be recorded. So this applies to every hearing at EMB, regardless of whether it's a registration hearing, a license hearing, a point hearing. If they take my license away for medical reasons and I object, I can get a hearing.
Okay.
All kinds of hearings.
All right. Now, Joe goes down into Section 3, which is 141D, which is the next one down from C, right?
Right.
Okay. Which talks about this hearing that we're going to talk about, that we just said we just referred to an A, B, and C. Now, what he's talking about is what?
I believe the senator was saying that the grounds for the reversal of the department's determination, which are in 12 through 14, misinterpretation of law, arbitrary and capricious manner, or determination unsupported by the evidence, that he felt those were too narrow. I believe that's what he was saying, although I'm not absolutely sure. Again, this is the language taken from existing law in the DWI area. It seems to me if you're talking about if it was a sufficient standard in that case in HB 6, I assume that the Senate would again find it sufficient here, which is partially why that language was relied upon. And again, I find it difficult to think of a situation where a person would want to reverse it, where the district court would reverse the hearing officer that wouldn't come within one of those three categories.
Okay. You satisfied, Senator Joseph?
I'm satisfied by the will of the committee.
Okay. Did you see, Senator Joseph, did you see the new section that's suggested to be put in there?
Yes, sir.
That provides for a new hearing? I would move that section be added in there. That's the number. An objection to that?
Yeah, but I guess it's all right.
Just move the draft.
Would that be the change?
That's with the change of the hearing officer.
A different hearing officer.
A different hearing officer. You're going to have it. I don't believe it. I don't think it makes any sense to give it back the same hearing officer. They hear it over again.
What they do in trial courts, but I can see where you would think it wouldn't make any sense. They send it back to the same judge. You just got reversed.
You used your discretion on this one.
Well, look at that. Now, on page 3, at the top of the page, it says the registered owner of vehicle may exercise this option only once for each vehicle.
Explain, Senator. Right now, there is an existing law, the language that you see there, which allows a person to register for only a portion of the month, or a portion of the year, excuse me. The intent was if somebody owns a fleet of cars or a family of three cars or something, he wants to register them all the same, so he doesn't have to go in January and then again in March and down in June. So it's for his convenience that he can pick a partial year and pay for a partial year 1 year and then bring them all into line and go from there. But what's been happening is people have been routinely coming in and saying, I only want to register this car May through August or June through July. And they're using it to get out of paying the yearly registration fee, and year after year coming in and designated only a partial year. But what's been happening is people have been routinely coming in and saying, I only want to register this car May through August or June through July. And they're using it to get out of paying the yearly registration fee, and year after year coming in and designated only a partial year, and then only paying a proportion of the registration fees. The intent of that was not to allow people to register their car only for 3 months out of the year, but for their convenience to bring all of their vehicles in line on that standard registration period. So that's what this does, is say, you can go ahead and exercise that option, but only once for each vehicle. You can't do it year after year.
Funny way to do it. I agree with you that it's a funny way to do it. What you're talking about is some people have spent 6 months outside with this one.
Yes. And they've been doing it year after year under this provision.
I think it's a silly way to do it, though. I wanted to just say, when you get your vehicle for the first time that you registered, for whatever is left of the year, and then pick it up at the regular time and start over again.
Because the regular time is different for each vehicle under our stagger. I might get a car and it's got to be registered again next March, but then 2 months later, my wife or my husband buys a car and then theirs has got to be registered.
Does it go on the guy's, go on your birthday? The owner?
No, because mine is registered in February and my birthday is September, so I don't think that's. I don't know how they figured it out to begin with. Your driver's license goes by your birthday.
Yeah, that's what I think. I would think that when you bought a car, you get 90 days in which time to register. And whenever you register, you register for the period ending until the end of the year, and that's it. And then from then on, you pay a yearly fee.
I'm not sure how they do that. I think they wanted to allow people some flexibility without only, basically abuse of privilege.
What's the committee's, yes, sir?
Mr. Chairman, just,
and say you're under arrest for drunking, for drunk driving. I want to give you a test. They can do that?
Yes, sir. If they have probable cause, if the person can definitely identify that that was John Smith, I know him, I saw him.
You can do that now.
But
the point being is that does this person who made that call have to come in and identify, have to go to court with him?
He'll have to come to the trial, yes, sir, because the police officer can't prove the case.
Well, there won't be a trial if he won't take breathalyzer, then would there?
Well, then he'd be charged with refusal to take the breath.
Right, so, you know, he's sort of in a rock and hard spot then.
He certainly is.
And he, in kind of fact, this person out there could have been wrong, totally wrong, or somebody else.
Could have been.
Just, so, that's what bothers me, but for operating.
I mean, if you refuse to take the test, then you go to court, for sure, and then at that time you'll have a chance to prove it, and then if it falls arrest...
I'm saying, he never drove the car. He never drove the car. Right. Somebody said he did.
Yeah.
The officer didn't see it. But he says, you're under arrest. You take this test. And I say, hey, no, I'm not. I've been sitting here all night. You're under arrest. Take the test. Oh, I refuse to. Okay. Then he loses his license, right?
Well, if the issue is identity and the person's under arrest, then obviously what he or she should do is take the test and then go to court and say, I was sitting here all night. My roommates at this table can prove that it wasn't me that was driving.
Yeah,
sure, I was drunk. I was drunk in the bar.
If a police officer comes into a bar and somebody sitting there, they're going to be required to take a test on somebody else's telephone call?
If the senator, there has got to be probable cause for an arrest.
But here's the original language is while operating or driving. I can understand if the police officer himself see them. If they stop him, obviously he's not driving or operating, he's stopped.
That's
but
right.
He's at the scene of the crime.
The language says while.
Nine times out of ten, if you go into a bar and if a policeman goes into a bar and the guy's been sitting there all night and he says, well, I want to be under arrest, I'm going to give you a test, and the guy will say, go to hell.
Right.
Nine times out of ten.
And that's 3 days in jail. Regardless if, Mr. Chairman.
Right away, you're intoxicated, and if you are that intoxicated, you'd say, hell with you, guy, I know where I've been. I've been here.
That's right.
You aren't arrested. You happen to go to hell. Right away from me.
And meanwhile, Mr. Chairman, while there may have been enough evidence to satisfy probable cause to uphold the arrest, which means the guy's going to do 3 days in jail. In fact, you might have been wrong. It would never be challenged to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt that the person identifying you earlier was in fact correct. It's just simply, well, it looked like him, you know, and so the officer had probable cause. And so you do 3 days in jail based on a perhaps erroneous identification.
But how do you suggest correcting it?
I suggest we insert the words immediately after, on line 27, after arrested. So it would read, if that person was arrested immediately after operating a motor or driving a motor vehicle.
This would not allow us to require a person to take a breath test.
Then the argument
after
would
he's
be
had a bad accident,
after.
I've heard several other people, and the officers get there, and he's left the scene, and they follow him, and he's at home, and they say, there's six other people in the hospital, we want you to come down and take a breath test. And that's not immediately after, and that guy should say, jump off limb, I'm not going to do it.
The guy ran away, and they couldn't find him for 5 hours.
No, but if they catch him driving the car, it doesn't matter how long ago the accident took place.
But they didn't catch him driving the car.
Well,
he left the scene.
I was responding to Senator Ray's advice. Excuse me.
Well, he left the scene. They don't know who he is. I think it was here, but they aren't sure. If the police arrive on the scene within 15 minutes after this terrible wreck out there, and there's 3-4 people laying around incapacitated, and the other car, the motor's still running, and the door is open, and the guy is gone.
You know, if the committee has any concern about it, I would say strike that whole section, because this was an attempt to clean up nonsensical language, which is absurd on its face. If it's a concern of the committee, take it out, because the way we're doing it now works well. It's the way it was intended to work. And if you put in like language like immediately after, you might as well just repeal the criminalization of the breath test refusal, because you'll be taking away the ability to require a breath test. And probably
oh, now, Ms. Horetsky.
That's true,
come
sir.
Now.
That's true.
How many breath tests are given at the scene when an officer pulls somebody over? What percentage?
You're talking about preliminary breath tests, or no breath tests are given at the scene other than preliminary breath tests?
What's
the breath test at the station?
No, it's when the arrest took place. When did the arrest take place?
We will decide this now, sir. How many people want to change this section? What is your hand?
There was never a motion.
I want to know how many people, and then we'll make a motion.
Of course, they're into a different arena than I am. I'm just concerned about what is wrong with the present language.
Present language doesn't make any sense.
Is there anything wrong with that? You're trying to fix something that's not broken. That's the whole issue. The
present language is bad because you don't arrest them while they're operating it, because they don't do that.
It's not bad because she says it hasn't made any effect. So what's,
Well, anybody that has... Let's think for a minute. You can't be arrested while you're driving a vehicle. You can't be arrested while you're doing that. You have to stop and sit there.
I know
the guy has to come and say you're under arrest.
I know that, but she says it's not a problem.
This was an attempt to clean up nonsensical language. No court has ever construed that you had to actually be arrested while you were motoring down the road.
All right.
It's a problem. Take it out.
It's not a problem. So why take it out?
I know some attorneys who are certain. So why don't we just leave it, Penal? Do you have that consideration? How many people want to take it out?
I want the governor's language.
So do I.
Let's ask him.
How about you, Bob? Well, we'll leave it in.
Leave the while in.
Yeah.
What? Leave the old language in?
No.
No.
He said leave it in.
Leave it in the way it is.
She's taking it out.
Leave the language as written.
I trust governorship.
In the governor's bill. As amended. Okay, gentlemen, I think we know more than we want to about this bill now.
Thank you.
Could I have a motion amendment, a movement? Something? No. No.
One.
Could I have an amendment, a motion to do something with the bill?
Oh, the amendment, yeah, the Oretzky amendment. I move the bill with the Oretzky amendment with the recommendation.
There's an objection. Do you want the Oretzky amendment? Do you want to make a committee substitute on it? That was easier. How many do pass? No rec?
Are we going to see the committee substitute before it's passed out?
No. That's when we're really going to do the work on it.
I know.
So it's just going to put that one in there.
It's a two-page amendment.
No, it's just a...
7 lines.
The session.
Joe, we're going to take up your... Senate Bill 385 now. This is the one I'm on related to the last petition on post on your education. Mm-hmm. And we wondered... Did you have a committee sub? You've been running around with one. I think you sent me one.
There is a committee substitute. Mr. Rumsfeld is here to speak to it.
Are you here to talk on it, Carrie? Are you?
Yeah.
All right. Why don't you come forward and identify yourself and give whatever testimony you need.
I might say the major reason for the committee substitute was a message from Ron Welsh of Sitka. Points out that we have students participating in recognized foreign exchange student programs, spending a school year abroad through ICYE, Rotary, or other recognized exchange programs. Some attend schools, others are on voluntary service programs. Technically, they might lose eligibility for student loans. Please amend SB 385 to protect their eligibility and legal residency status.
Thank you. I'm Kerry Rumsberg, Director of the Commission on Post-Secondary Education. The bill before you, at least the first section, is an attempt to clean up some language and to fix some parts of the student loan statutes that we have attempted to fix for 4 years in a row. And usually what happens is, as the bill progresses through the Senate, someone amends it or adds something to it that becomes controversial, and the bill gets stopped somewhere along the line. So we tried, through the governor's office, to introduce what we consider to be a non-controversial bill in an attempt to fix some things. And I'd like to just point out what we need to fix. On the first page, line 17, well, I'm looking at the committee substitute. Let me just say, section 1, part 2, where it talks about serving an initial period for up to 4 years. Currently, the language says that an individual receives deferment from payment and from interest accruing while they're serving on active duty as a member of the armed forces. And that effect of that is, as long as the person stays in the service, we cannot collect from them, and interest doesn't accrue. If they're a 20-year servicemen or 30 years, we have to track them for 20 or 30 years, interest doesn't accrue, and then we have to try to collect. That was a change that was made a few years ago. Senator Bradley added that language a few years ago, and it got through, and we would like to see that change back the way it used to be, which means the initial period of up to 4 years, and we really think that that's sufficient for anyone to have interest deferred and payments deferred.
Senator Bradley was from Akron, wasn't he?
Well, wait a minute. Which is, does this mean, suppose that I have a, I take out a loan of $5,000 and I've had the loan for 4 months and I go into service. Is that what this refers to? That's correct. Then what? Then I wait 4 years before I pay any back?
If you've enrolled, if you've enlisted for 4 years or for three, you're deferred during that first enlistment period. That's correct. This is the way the language is
written. Do you have a deferment up to 4 years?
That's right.
Be a good way to get around paying them back.
But under the present
heavy
plan,
price to pay.
Under the existing plan, if you re-up and stay in for 20 or 30 years, you're insulated.
You never pay.
You never pay.
Oh, you never pay it now.
That's why he wants to change.
That's why he wants to change it.
Sounds good to me. Okay, now
on the second page, at the top, and we do all have the committee substitute, so it's line 8, item number 2 is new language. We're saying that if an individual, to qualify for a loan, we want to make sure they're not in default or delinquent on a previously awarded loan. Right now, we are in the awkward position of an individual being defaulted on an earlier loan, coming back, asking for more money, and the attorney tells us we must award them that an additional loan, even though they're in default on a previous one. But we'd like to change that.
Change attorneys.
Okay. And then the large part of this bill that is most of it, it starts on the bottom of that second page and goes over onto the next. It sets the circumstances under which an individual can be physically present or physically away from Alaska, but still qualify for a student loan. Because the way the language reads right now is that a person has to be physically present 2 years before applying, unless they are absent from the state for military service, and that's the only exception. If we really enforce that rigorously, what we would say is if an individual would borrow to be for their freshman year and go to the University of Oregon, for instance, and then want to borrow for their sophomore year, the way the current law reads, they have to come back to Alaska and spend 2 more years before they can borrow for their sophomore year. We know that's not the intention of the legislature, because we assume it isn't, and we have not been enforcing it in that fashion. But we would like to be in compliance, and we're asking for this to be changed. So what we're saying is, you may have absence due to military service, volunteer service, the one that's added, participation in a foreign exchange, as a foreign exchange student. And by the way, we would define that as being enrolled full-time as a student, because a couple of these programs that are cited as foreign exchange students, a person can go overseas and work full-time and not be enrolled at all. We would not include them in that kind of...
What you're saying is participating full-time in a foreign exchange student program recognized by the commission.
That's correct. And through regulation, we would make sure that met the full-time student. The next one, adding the language of adding school full-time. That means if they're attending full-time. Full-time employment by the state, which was one that was suggested by the governor's office, being fully employed or full-time employed by the state's congressional delegation, medical reasons, or the spouse of one of the above.
Well, let me ask you something about the congressional delegation, Mr. Chairman, if I might. If a person is hired by, say, Congressman Young, and the person lives in Maryland, has never been in Alaska, works for Young for 2 years,
No, this language says, and I skipped over it, it says that you've been physically present in the state 2 years before any of this has occurred. So you can't gain residence, physical presence while you're outside. By the way, if I can just digress for one small moment, the only test we have for residency any now is 2 years physical presence. That was upheld in the federal court last year, about a year ago or this month. The court said that we can insist upon 2 years physical presence. That's the only test we use. And then these are the conditions under which they've already met that, and then they leave the state. The Section 3 under Wichy.
Sure. Carrie, can you, this full-time employment by the state, I don't know of any particular circumstance, but what if someone was fully employed by a corporation in the state, or they had to go out and back in? Why would the state person be exempt while this other one wouldn't be?
They would be ineligible under the current law and under this. And if you're asking for a justification of why that would happen,
I mean, why would they be treated differently than anybody else employed in the state who had to go outside for something?
You have to understand that we take a very hard line on these, and we've been turning down everybody. And the governor said, you know, if we have a person who's going to our Japanese office or something like that and working for the state of Alaska, that seems a legitimate reason. and this language was inserted by them. We didn't ask for it. I can certainly see that their point of view. They're working on behalf of the state of Alaska.
Yeah, maybe Overstreet wants to come back.
But the question, of course, is if someone was under full control by someone else in the state.
We have state troopers and people in the Revenue Service that are employed in the state of Washington, but they're employed full time by the state of Alaska in Seattle. You knew that, didn't you?
I know we have a revenue office down there.
And they would be ineligible, however, unless they had spent 2 years physically present here before they were employed and went out. Simply being hired by the state doesn't give you residence. But the basic education makes, I can't justify.
Before we move on to Section 3, I wonder if I could...
You want to talk about Subsection B in there?
Personnel? No, I wanted to talk about a proposed amendment to Subsection 2. Immediately before, there'd be a new Section 4 distributed to the committee.
You did?
Yes. Should be in your packet.
I'm having a little trouble with that.
I wonder what your reaction would be
there. Well, excuse me, I'm not making light of it by smiling. It would be difficult to administer, and it may, well, for one thing, we'd have to determine those individuals that were 18 and male. We don't ask sex on the application. We would have to then determine those that, we'd have to ask for evidence. I guess they'd have to turn in some kind of documentation.
They have to have it if they register.
That's correct, and they have to copy it and send it to us, apparently. That's how we
seem like an overdue burden.
They'll get money free anyway.
So aside from some potential administrative problems that you might foresee, that's the only area that you would have objection to. I'm asking a question.
I would respond philosophically. I'm not sure that it's appropriate to use state-level financial aid to enforce federal requirements. I would have to give it a lot more thought than just looking at it here.
Well, I could see another problem, which is, are not some people claim that they are constitutionally privileged to not register for religious reasons? I don't know what the status of that is, but suppose someone...
Well, then they've got an answer on education.
Suppose someone said that I am a conscientious objector, and I don't know what a conscientious objection in all faiths goes to, even service or registration. Would you be in a position, if that hypothetical is correct, of having to determine whether that person is entitled to the privilege of conscientious objection?
I hope we wouldn't be in that position. You're asking me to put an opinion outside of my field of expertise, and I can't give you a good answer.
You could correct that, but if required, if not,
maybe if you can.
You put in there, if you're required to
register.
Yeah, he's not required if they have a religious freedom exclusion, then that's fine. That would be required.
Right.
So if you put those two words on there, when required, is not failed to register for the selected service. Does that take care of your problem, Chris?
I think it should.
I give it to you.
You're going to get things illegal here with nobody wanting to live up there.
Well, there really is a very small. I think Alaska leads the United States in terms of percentage that comply with the Selective Service law. That's right. But there are, I imagine, a couple hundred or maybe a few score that don't. I certainly think that's we're not being unreasonable.
Did you want to move that amendment?
I'd move the amendment.
Is it objected to the letter? So ordered. With the words, when required, as
right.
Section B, which starts on line 12.
Could we go back up there just a little bit? You got the subsection B on line 10. Here. Person does not qualify as a resident of the state under the sixth if the person declares or establishes a resident of another state during the absence from Alaska. Do you have any criteria on that? Do you do that in regulations or what?
Yes, and generally what that is this is the cap.
You have a thing set up right in there.
All
right.
Yes. Okay. The next section, section 3, is one that removes some language in which this is purely cleanup, whether it's passed or not. has sort of no effect on the program. We can't send students into petroleum engineering anyway because it's not an exchange field. It was added as a potential exchange field, if my memory serves me right, by you, Senator, a few years ago when we added architecture. It's not an exchange field, and the other states didn't agree that it should be, so we're taking it back out.
We have to take it out.
Section 4 is a request from language requested by the Attorney General's office. It refers to violations under our authorization to operate law, and it refers to provisions of AS 1440.020, and then within AS 1440.020, it in turn refers to the underlying portion, which is AS 1448.060B, and the Attorney General feels that that should be added directly instead of indirectly through the law. And those are the only changes.
Okay. Have you got your right language in here, Joe?
Yes,
right language in here.
Yeah.
And Fritz, we'll put yours in there as a number 9. Which one? What number do you want yours?
It would be number 4 on page 3, line 11.
Why?
Because it refers, it's referring back, Mr. Chairman.
Number 4?
I think it'd be better than me.
Why would you say number 4?
Well, we're talking about a person may apply for and obtain a scholarship loan if the person, number 1, is, number 2, is not delinquent, number 3, is a resident. This should just be a fourth requirement.
Okay. I see. All right. So then we have the committee substitute with that amendment. What do you say, gentlemen? Objection? How many do pass?
Advised our office that as of January 1st, 1984, there were 1,334 felons incarcerated in the Alaska correction system.
at the 1983 dividend rate of $386 per resident. Last year, there would have been dividends totaling approximately $515,000 available for appropriation to the Crime Victims Compensation Fund. Section 4 provides that this act only affects eligibility for dividends for years after 1984. Section 5 states that it is the intent of the legislature that an amount of money approximately equal to the amount that would have been paid to incarcerated felons be appropriated annually from the dividend fund to the Crime Victim Compensation Fund. Because of the constitutional problems posed with dedication of funds, we cannot have the Commissioner of Revenue directly deposit money from the dividend fund into the Crime Victims Compensation Fund. This legislature will have to appropriate it. Section 6 provides for an immediate effective date. I'd be happy to answer any questions which members of the committee might have.
Have you seen any committee substitutes? One of them proposed by Josephson?
Mr. Chairman, I got a copy of the committee substitute when I came in today. I have only given it a cursory review. In a technical sense, it appears to do what the what is intended. I have not spoken with any of the sponsors of the bill in the House, so I do not know what their position on the substitute would be. It is a philosophical decision for the members of this committee to make as to whether or not they want to allow spouses or children of incarcerated felons to receive permanent fund dividends. If I could make one or two comments for the members to consider on that particular point. There is always a social cost when someone is sent to prison. When a person is sent to prison, he can no longer provide money to his family, either legally or illegally, however he was doing it previously. I think that we have already made a decision as a society that in certain cases a person will be sent to prison, regardless of whether or not there is a cost to his family. Not allowing his family to get his permanent fund dividend would simply be an extension of a social policy which we have already adopted. I would point out that the felony...
What are you saying, sir?
Well, we've already...
You don't want to give him the money, is that what you're saying?
I'm just... it's not...
It's your belief that if we... by taking it away from them originally, that we would be violating that policy if we gave it back to their spouse or the children? Is that what you're saying?
In effect. I would also point out that if the felon is not living at home because he is in prison, his permanent fund dividend is not needed by his family to offset his share of his family's living expenses. Giving a check to the spouse, particularly a non-dependent spouse, would be a bonus to that spouse above and beyond the permanent fund bonus she or he has already received.
Maybe the spouse and the children are happy that he is living someplace else, even though they aren't making it on their own, and they are wards of the state at that time.
One last point is that we do have a state and federal welfare system to help the needy. If someone becomes legally needy, and I say legally needy in the sense that someone legally qualifies for welfare, simply because they lose their spouse's $350 permanent fund dividend for a given year, they can apply for welfare and receive it. This committee substitute would give a spouse a permanent fund dividend regardless of whether or not she had any need for it.
Okay. Any other questions, gentlemen?
Yeah, we're talking about the taking away the brothers from
yes.
People who have been incarcerated.
Yes.
I have a question or two.
Okay.
A felony is anything more than a year, right?
Like
a year and a day, okay. Lost away one. What about a misdemeanor who gets almost a year?
This bill would only apply to felons.
Do you think that's fair? I mean, suppose the guy's in jail and he's in there for 1 year and the guy next to him is in there for a year and a day.
Well, of course, the legislature has made the decision that certain crimes will be classified as felonies.
I understand all that, but what I'm saying is why shouldn't a misdemeanor have half of his fund taken away if he's incarcerated? Maybe his bonus. I don't like this bill. Together.
Somehow it's getting that. Are you done with your question, sir?
Yes, for the time being.
Senator Eliason?
Well, what bothers me is that I don't know if there's any provisions made for the Child Enforcement Division receiving those funds. I think the original bonus plan provided for them those payments to go to that division to enforce child care. Now, is that being dropped out in this provision? And you're committing substitute.
But Dick is saying is there is a provision under the child care statute that if there can be a lien on the
We were told here by Dan a month ago that
a number of those people did not apply for the permanent fund dividend because of the fact that, number one, they didn't want to let the state know where they were. Number two, that they did not want to give those funds to the Child Enforcement Division. But under this provision here, they're, even though there are, do not apply, they're going to be eligible for it.
You have to change the language, then, Joe, to put an exclusion on that. Exclusion, you mean that would go to the... Well, if the money is already, if it's going to go to the Child Enforcement, that's where it should go.
Right.
In other words, it would be primary, and this would be secondary,
right.
And the state, if I have my way, would be thirdary.
Tertiary.
Tertiary, there you go.
I wanted to see if you would wait, Chris. It would be tertiary, because I believe that if there are no spouse or no dependent children, the money should be returned to the state for the care of the child while he's in prison.
Well, that's the, we talked about this with various ideas. One was to just have the state have its own lien, on the dividend to help offset the cost of care.
Could you originally? Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
May I have a dialogue with my colleague on my right here? I really is on my left. Look, one time all you had to do was be here on January 3rd, 1959, got to live here for 25 years, right? Continuously. And then you're eligible for the bonus. There's nothing in that law that said if you ever have a hard luck and now convicted of a felony, you're going to get deprived of the bonus.
The only requirement...
Where's the beef, Senator? I
the beef is that the only requirement under law, it doesn't say you have to be a good citizen. It doesn't even say you have to be a citizen.
I agree with you.
You have to be a resident for 6 months.
I said in my memorandum that I don't necessarily support any version of this legislation. This subject came up, and I offered to help do the drafting. I don't know if you looked at my scalp, but I am not Ramona Barnes.
The language that you might want, Joe... is the exemption provided by this section does not apply to the collection of a debt owed to the state or to a court-ordered payment of restitution to the victims of a crime.
I mean,
that's the language you want to put in there?
That's you took the word out of my mouth.
That's good. But you take it right out of the other one. Take it right out of the other bill. Out of the permanent fund dividend.
Well, Mr. Chairman, as a matter of fact, the Senator is catching him aloud.
Certainly, sir.
And as Mr. Christensen, I'm a little confused as to what the purpose public policy
be confused.
And what is really the objective here? I mean, is it to sort of add another sanction against people who committed crimes?
Sure. I agree with you, Joe. But people aren't even punished. That's where they're doing time.
Yeah.
And
so
now you're going to hit them again in the pocketbook this time.
I've heard it expressed as I certainly don't subscribe to this, but as an effort by small-minded people to punish and punish and punish. I don't subscribe to that.
The basic philosophy behind it, as I said at the beginning of my remarks, is that the permanent fund serves as a bonus to people, to reward people for being residents of this state. And if by your residence in this state you've caused pain and suffering to other residents of this state, there's no good reason to reward you for living here.
Sir, Corey, what are you going to do with those people who are in prison for the 25 years that they attained, they were in the bucket for 5 or 6 years, let's say, in 1960 sometime. Are you going back retroactively and take away the bonus they received in those days or whenever they did for a couple years ago?
No, this bill is only operative for permanent fund bonuses received.
Oh, he means following your line of reasoning, is what he's saying. There is a possibility for a class action suit for the denial of... because there is nothing in the policy statement, as I remember, in the permanent fund dividends, it doesn't say anything about any requirement other than you be here 6 months or a year, whatever it is, whatever the requirement is. They don't say you have to be a good citizen, bad citizen, you don't even have to be a citizen. You just have to live here. And it's your share of the revenues off of the permanent fund.
Yes, sir. Well, my concern would be that then somebody's going to come in next year and say, well, if you receive public assistance, you shouldn't get permanent.
That'll be the next thing.
It's going to go on.
If you've had trouble with your scalp or something like that. Well, I mean, that's...
I'm sorry.
This is, makes it more palatable if the family gets it. I don't mind that.
They didn't earn it.
Could be the team.
Yes, he qualified.
Yeah, he qualified that.
Now you're taking away his qualifications.
Well, now we have, I agree with your argument, but when you say they're earning it, part of it, they were putting up with a sucker. Once where they earned it.
I wonder if Senator Joseph has considered how this may affect spousal testimony against her husband. She may be looking at that permanent fund dividend.
$385?
Put it away. She wants that money.
Some men aren't worth $385, Mr. Chairman.
Must this applies to husbands?
As you can see, that there is a mixed emotion from the committee. Okay, sir, thank you. Patrick Connelly. Don't bore us, sir.
I'm Pat Connelly from the Department of Law. I will not bore you, Senator. Two issues have been raised. One is Senator Josephson's committee substitute, which we just got our hands on, and only had a chance to do a cursory review. Another was an issue that was raised by Senator Eliason.
Briefly,
I raised one too.
Pardon?
I thought I raised one too.
You raised a number, but they were more policy oriented things, Senator Ziegler, rather than administrative protective issues. And I will address the administrative protective issues. Senator Eliason, the part about the priority of who gets the permanent funds and everything else. The permanent fund program is set up that under the law, in order to collect a dividend, you have to fulfill two things. Number one, you have to be a resident. That's Senator Ray's thing. The other thing is you have to apply. Basically, when we're talking about people in jail and stuff, they're not applying. And so it would be a necessity of adding extremely heavily to the administrative cost if we were to say, okay, let's match up those people who we're going to declare ineligible, and then they're otherwise eligible, and we'll take their money and we'll give it to child support enforcement to pay to these people. Makes a match, and that's somewhat similar to Senator Josephson's committee substitute. Basically, subsection E here, which provides it to the spouses of independent children, raise a number of significant points that could be somewhat problematic. We would have to pinpoint track the individual who the spouse is applying for. We're going to end up probably adding about 10 people to the state payroll by putting this in there just to keep you keep an idea.
Please.
Am I boring you? Don't have some.
No, you're not boring us, but you're insulting our intelligence a little bit.
Is that right before the bill or is
it? All I'm trying to say, Senator Josephson, is that you're taking it out of something that you can take a computer run from one institute, from one group, i.e. the people in the corrections agency, and matching it up against a computer run against in revenue. Now you're saying we'll have to make determinations not to whether or not the spouse who was incarcerated was an eligible person. Because if the spouse the person who's in jail is eligible.
Well, you do that already.
Yes, but we do it for that individual. We don't do it for their spouse.
Yeah.
We'd have to make a determination on what a dependent child was. And what you're talking about here is matching this up with a listing or the adult Department of Adult Corrections.
What, did you talk about 1,500 people? They take 10 new full-time employees to take care of 10?
1,300 people.
1,300 people?
I
could take care of them myself.
That'd be one.
Fuck, silly.
Well, however how many it takes, you're going to necessitate putting people on to do this. The thing that I do like about Senator Josephson's committee substitute is the new Section 5. I think broadening the purpose of Section, as he has done for the intent of the expenditure of money, goes a long way in significantly undercutting any class action suit that may possibly be brought by a prisoner who's denied a permanent fund dividend. Okay. It gives greater validity to a rational basis to be served by this legislation.
I agree.
Would only suggest that it could even be more broader.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. What about that approach? What about not denying the individual his permanent fund dividend and not pulling into this gruesome battery with the spouse or the child, but simply
having a general fund lien on it as partial reimbursement to the state for the cost of that person's custody. I mean, it could cost.
If you set it up in that way, I think you would follow up the dedicated fund. Unless you just said that it went back in the
general fund. Yeah.
And it's the intent to be appropriated in that way.
What about that? I mean, there's a case that many people
are costing the state a lot of money.
You know,
$25,000 a year.
They're costing us $25,000 a year, and that we have a huge corrections budget and capital expense. We ought to recoup the $380.
That would make it even more.
You know what the effect of that would be? It would mean that none of them would ever apply, and that everybody else in the state would get a slightly larger permanent fund.
No, that way it's set up. We've taken into account the way the bill came out of the House, we took into account the fact that they could never apply.
We're still trying to get that $541 million to get floating over there.
All right. Okay. Well, I like that better. I mean, give them the dividend and then take it back.
They don't give them the dividend at all.
I'm
just saying that they would
send a last and a.
I'm not quite clear whether you support the concept or you don't support it.
I was just talking about the administration.
So who's going to give us the administration's position on this particular bill?
Regarding whether or not it's a good idea in the policy manner.
Yeah. Somebody probably has some ideas up there, whether they like it or not.
See,
do you know?
Do I know whether it's, I think the word was that was conveyed to Senator Wade was it didn't. Didn't matter one way or the other. That's only secondhand through my boss. But Senator Ray can probably tell you better than I could have.
I don't know about it.
Mr. Chairman, I think there's a difference between saying you don't get the dividend in the first place and saying you get the dividend except that the state has a lien on it. Because if you do it the second way, you're less likely to create encroachments on this basic fundamental right that Senator Zilber was talking about. You still preserve the notion that every Alaskan by right of residency is entitled to that dividend.
They're only entitled to that dividend if they apply for the dividend. It would necessitate either a wholesale change in the way the permanent fund dividend law is presently administered.
You'll do a lot of dividend.
Wait, because you'd have to eliminate, then you'd have to apply. They do apply now, and they do get it.
What is going to
horses. Contraband.
I would like to carry that on, though. Your idea, just that one another. If there's nobody else at the state gets it, if they want to apply for it, the state's going to get it.
Well, apply for it. Permanent fund dividend will be a little bit bigger.
No, that isn't the way it works.
No,
they just allocate X amount of dollars and divide it all up there. They sit down there with a Ouija board, you know. That's why they got $540 million left.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to see. I think lower respect. Let's find out how serious the administrative problem would be.
The original
somebody from the Department of Revenue.
The original fiscal loan on it, which would do the same thing as he's talking about, is $34,000.
No, Senator, there was another fiscal note submitted. I think it was $50,000 or $60,000. There's somebody here from the Department of Revenue that could at least do it from that.
No, on the original, or the committee substitute is $34,800. That's from the revenue?
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
You got ten $3,000.
That was the finance. That's the finance version, Senator. There was a House Judiciary version too.
Well, we're going on the finance. It's the last bill that came.
That's correct. But you're changing the bill.
You're not changing it.
We're
making
it
easier. We're making it easier. We'll just collect the money. Thanks, Pat.
Where'd you get the 10 people, though? That's what
it was just a figure. I'm not in the corrections department, nor is.
Just something to think about, right?
Thanks, Pat. Urban Jones. Sincerely, I do thank you, Pat.
Thank you, Senator.
My name is Urban Jones. I'm the Director of Administrative Services. And I'm one of the people that have to administer this bill if in fact it is passed in the first. And listening to the testimony so far, the first of all, I'd like to point out that it would not take 10 people to do either version of this bill. The fiscal note that was attached to the House Finance and System had substituted for one additional investigator, and marginal amounts of supply only. That was premised upon receiving a magnetic tape from the director now the Department of Corrections that would list all of those convicted felons that were serving time during that eligibility period. It would make the comment before they've given a list like that, it makes little difference as to what the reason is that they're on the list. We can match that against the PFD file and eliminate those people who file. The bill as it passed House Finance would be a dual bill, first of all. It satisfied the Department of Revenue's concerns in two areas. One is that it's possible to identify felons, first of all, to deny the applications, and the second thing is it separates the funding so that it simply makes a statement that the estimated amount of money that would have been paid to these people is available for appropriation to the crime victims fund. It's, of course, from the Department of Revenue standpoint, it's a real concern as to what happens to the money as far as what it's appropriated for. But having it separated that way serves it makes it a lot more clear cut. And looking at the committee substitute that was offered this morning, I went through it earlier this morning, and there were only two areas really that I'd like to talk about. They are both in the area of what's been called administrative difficulty, and I want to suggest that administrative difficulty can be a very important factor if you're talking about a program as large